This program was brought to you by Eat On North. Eat On North is a casual restaurant where honest, uncomplicated food is served without pretension. Find Eat On North at hotelonnorth.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America, I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain on Heritage Radio Network. I'm a chef, I'm a former Army sniper, and I guess most importantly, a lifelong hunter. And I am very excited today to have Judith Schwartz, on the phone today, and we're going to be talking about animal tracking. Judith is a longtime freelance writer with wide-ranging experience with books, magazines, newspapers, and a variety of writing and editing clients. She has written articles for women's magazines, Co and Ghost, written books with therapists and doctors, which makes me a little nervous. Judith, we're going to talk about that, as well as a couple of her own. She is trained as a therapist and written a novel based on her grandmother's psychoanalyst, who was a member of Freud's inner circle in Vienna. That's amazing. She is the author of an amazing book called Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. And today, most importantly, she has written an article for Discovery Magazine, produced in partnership with Food and Environment Reporting Network. And it's coming out in December. And it's a really, I was lucky enough to get it under embargo in my mailbox. And it was really an amazing article. I've read it four or five times now. I couldn't put it down. So, Judith, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, well, thank you, Chad.
Did I cover everything?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, one detail. Also, the article was also supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And, you know, these support from these organizations is important to mention because it's really hard for journalists to be able to dig into stories and be able to travel for stories and for those stories to be told. It means a lot that we are able to get support for the work.
All right. Awesome. So again, the article was amazing. You know, for a hunter like myself and former Army sniper, you know, tracking kind of was a natural thing for me growing up in the woods, hunting with my family, and then you know, in service to our country. It always kind of came naturally to me. So reading this article and kind of the history of it and how modern technologies are playing in was very interesting. What made you kind of decide to get into this subject matter?
Ah, okay. So what led me to this article? As with many things, there are many routes that lead to the same place. For one thing, my husband, Tony E. Pryle, is from South Africa originally. So I've spent a lot of time in the Southern African parks, and he wanted to be a game ranger when he grew up, like I think many South African children of that generation. It was, you know, that all these animals are incredible. It's romantic, the sun, the sound of the birds, etc. And so, so through him, I've been interested in that landscape, and through his knowledge of animals, I've been able to tune into the wildlife there. And then, as you mentioned, I wrote this book called Cows Save the Planet, in which I explore, among other, it's a book about soil as a hub for many environmental, economic, and social crises, and for solutions. Now, the title, Cows Save the Planet, is a nod to the work of Alan Savory, who is a character who is featured in this tracking article because he is one of the great trackers of our era. I mean, he's brilliant. I'd been writing about his work in Holistic Plan Grazing, which is the use of livestock as a tool for large-scale land restoration. And this work, I explore this in my book, and I understood it. And
right, and you talk about that in
places,
the article.
Many ranches where they had used this. But there was this other side of Alan that I felt, if I'm writing about him and I want to understand where his insights about animal-land interactions came from, that it was important to go to Zimbabwe and really see where this work began. And so...
Right. So,
I did.
Well, and you talked about that natural approach to grazing animals a little bit in the article. Alan, I feel like I know him now a little bit through your writing. So, you know, job well done. Can you talk a little bit about him and his kind of persona and who he, you know, what he kind of encompasses?
Okay. So, Alan is... he is considered controversial. He's kind of like been given this, he has this label of being controversial because many, many people, including environmentalists, including a kind of anti-meat, kind of a, you know, like the vegan brigade, get very concerned and really don't like this notion. They think that he's pro-cow. But to understand it, Alan's work came out of Africa, and the history of it is that when he was working in the game parks, like my husband, he loved animals, and he did achieve that goal of becoming of working in the parks. And so when he was working in wildlife, he observed that even from his childhood, the animals were disappearing, that the land was not as full of them as they had been. You know, the large herds of ungulates, of wildebeest, of zebra, of buffalo, and all manner of antelope. And he saw that this was, that the land was not as vibrant, not as rich. So further, when they were putting together when they were establishing the game parks, they often set land aside because the authorities determined that there were too many animals, and that was the problem. Okay, so let's put this land aside and let's, you know, put up a fence and make sure that we don't have more animals coming through. And then the land deteriorated further. So he came to the conclusion that grasslands, and in southern Africa, we're talking savanna, it's a grassland ecosystem, that savanna, grasslands and grazing animals evolved together so that the animals, that land needed the animals in the same way that the animals needed the land.
Right.
And further, that while overgrazing is definitely a problem, land can also be undergrazed, that land requires some kind of impact, some animal disturbance to truly flourish,
right,
and to be able to support biodiversity and to fulfill its ecological potential.
So, that aspect of it within the article, you wrote a little bit about how, you know, obviously he came from a more traditional background of tracking animals. And then you started kind of talking about how the GPS, other modern technologies, different apps that are available now kind of play in. But they all begin with this traditional way of seeing where the animals migrate, where they move, their natural corridors, all these things that happen. Is the technology ever going to get to a point where we won't need Alan out there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Okay, first of all, about the different technologies, I think that they support the initial observation as opposed to replacing them. For example, we also, in the article, I talk about this fellow named Louis Liebenberg, who is South African. He's written a lot about this, and he believes that tracking is the origin of science. I mean, he goes very far how it's basically the origin of human scientific thought. And so he has developed this technology, a kind of interface for smartphones called Cyber Tracker. And what it does is it allows people to input information and to share that information. And it uses icons that you can press. So that was important because a lot of the master trackers are not literate in, you know, conventional languages.
Right.
So, but that doesn't replace the observation. That facilitates the communication about the observations. So I think that's one thing. And you ask, will these technologies ever replace tracking? Louis Liebenberg said a couple of interesting things. First of all, he said that he always makes it a point to sometimes not use any devices so that he can 100% tune into the landscape, that he wants to make sure he doesn't lose that appreciation of the textures, of the sounds, of the smells, of everything that is telling him what is going on in the land and which animals have been there and how long before and all that. He also said that he believes that tracking will be, that it will be the last kind of human task that can be replaced by technology because there are so many nuances to it. Like, he said that when people think about tracking, they think that, oh, you're going to find a hoof print and it is going to be clear and is going to tell you exactly this or that.
Yeah.
But he said, no, usually things are blurry and maybe you don't know if that's because of time or because of wind blowing soil. So he said that because of the level of nuance that he thinks that tracking is pretty safe for the time being.
Which is very interesting. As a hunter, everything you just said is so true. I mean, that connection with the environment, I think, for me, is the most important thing. I mean, once I get on a property that I am going to hunt to harvest an animal, you know, you kind of get a feel for it after time, and you start to learn, you know, their routes, their kind of method for working that property, you know, their survival instinct within that property. And then, you know, the droppings, the hoof print, the other stuff all ties in and kind of just justifies your initial thought. I've used Google Earth, you know, before I even step out on a property, and I'll kind of look at the aerial picture of where I'm going to be hunting and, you know, look for the low ground, the high ground, the water source, the thicker woods where I know they're going to bed down and try to hide. How does this, you know, as a hunter, I understand, and even back when I was a soldier, I understand the benefit of tracking. For the environmentalist, isn't there easier ways for them? I mean, can't they just get up in helicopters, fly over, count the animals, let them do their natural thing, try to protect them? Is this really going to help the protection of the animal and the environment?
Yeah, I would say so, because it does provide another tool. First of all, I imagine that there's kind of a limit to what you can do via helicopter, because, you know, because of all the signs of animals. I mean, first, there are animals, for example, that are very shy or nocturnal, and so you might not see, they're very hard to find. So tracking can give you clues about them, you know, on the ground tracking. And also, it allows you to put pieces together, pieces of information together. And that's one of the ways that it's helpful, because it can tell, well, okay, one example, the people that I talked to from Elephant Voices, they told me that the tracking has also they have a tool called Ellie app, and then they also have their own tracking skills and all that, and they combine them so that it has given them more insight into elephants and elephant behavior. So they learned that the elephants were able to know when it's a market day or not.
Wow.
Because on market days, I think this was in Kenya, that on market days, the elephants avoided their usual path.
Right.
So I think it's the ability to take lots of different pieces of information.
Right, so a more detailed kind of look at the bigger picture that we're seeing. That's amazing. One thing that struck me, as we're about to head into a break, and maybe we could after the break finish talking about this. You had mentioned how this technology and this idea of bringing, you know, tracking a little, making it a little more modern, will help prevent poaching.
And, that is something I very much want to address.
Me too, yeah, because as a hunter and a conservationist, nothing bothers me, obviously, more than that. So, but let's save that and talk about that right after the break. We're going to take a break right here. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Brian Alberg, and I'm the executive chef at Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts is a casual restaurant where good, honest, uncomplicated food is served to our guests. Our restaurant is part of a hotel called Hotel On North, the newly opened boutique hotel in downtown Pittsfield. We source local ingredients from our neighboring farms and offer an all-day dining menu of flavorful American cuisine for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and on weekends we serve brunch. Our oyster bar serves up delicious shellfish and oyster samplers until 11 p.m. Check out our menu at eatonnorth.com and follow us on Instagram.
Here's what Heritage Radio Network would sound like without donations. It's not as good as the show you were just listening to, is it? Give us a few bucks. Help keep us running. HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Click the Donate tab on the top right corner.
Hey, welcome back to the Wild Game Domain. I am joined today by Judith Schwartz, who wrote a very interesting article about tracking in this month's Discover, this month or next month's Discover magazine.
It's in December, but the way that magazines are, they always come out a little bit ahead of time.
Okay, so start looking for it. It's really an amazing article. Okay, Judith, so before the break, we started talking about poaching, and I think I hit a chord with you.
Yeah, okay. So poaching in southern Africa is a huge and very, very concerning problem, particularly with elephants and rhino. So I had an interesting conversation with Alan Savory about this recently. And one thing that he pointed out, okay, I have a lot to say about this. We'll get back to the tracking.
Okay.
But one thing that he pointed out is the difference in the effect between hunting animals and poaching animals. He said that when animals are hunted, that hunters usually take the males. And therefore, this does not have a devastating effect on the population,
right?
Because obviously the females are the one to give birth to young.
Right.
So poaching, on the other hand, favors the females, and this is because of that they use snares and they use dogs. And he says that this tends to capture females, and this does have a devastating effect on the population. So I thought that was a really, really interesting distinction to be made. So in fact, he said that that research has found that, actually, I didn't follow up on this research, but I'll just put it out there because I thought it was interesting, of different animals, when you take the males are taken, sometimes the population even grows. There was some research on rats when this was the case.
Sure.
Okay, so, but the question of whether tracking helps poachers or helps capture.
Well, that's
poachers.
Where I was going, because my diabolical mind said to myself, are we, with these apps, aren't we helping the poachers?
Well, I mean, you know, poachers are, by definition, good trackers.
Right.
They're good at what they do. Okay, just to step back just a second, poaching is a symptom of social and economic breakdown in poor rural areas. I mean, I think that's really important to understand, because if we're really going to resolve the problem of poaching, it is going to be by addressing the needs of the communities that live among these animals. Okay, so that's a whole different conversation. But in terms of tracking, yes, it will help conservation. It will help it will help the side of saving the animals in many ways. One is that tracking will allow people working to find, to locate poachers and to stop poaching. It will allow conservationists to use their resources more efficiently.
Right, kind of know
where. The more information they have, the more they'll be able to, you know, be in the right place at the right time.
Right, I was just going to say, but kind of use the assets to cut off those choke points where we know the animals are in jeopardy almost, right? Where we know the poacher is going to want to be, and then we could put rangers or whatever assets we need to put there.
Exactly.
And
yes.
That was a big part. You know, again, as a conservationist, as an animal lover, you know, and I know some people listening out there may not get it. Listen to all my shows and then you'll understand the whole idea. You know, that was huge. If this technology can help protect, you know, the lions, we just saw that case of the dentist here who
yes.
went there and, you know, a horrible story. If we could prevent things like that from happening, then this is a wonderful undertaking. What can we expect moving forward in these technologies? I mean, is it evolving? Is it like all technologies? I mean, is it just going so fast we can't keep up with it? Or are we going to see a plateau? Or can we help? Is there any way my listeners could get involved? Should we be using this here? Should my Department of Environmental Control be looking into these technologies? Where do you see this going?
Well, I think that we're at a point where people in general are experiencing a longing for connection to nature. And I think that the uproar about Cecil the Lion, and by the way, that the Wangi Park is very close to the Africa Center for Holistic Management and the communities that I villaged and the communities that I visited in Zimbabwe. I think we're seeing that. I think that there is an increased interest in tracking, in part, as a way for people to connect with nature. I think we're about to experience a shift in that direction, just from what I'm observing. But in terms of the technology, I think it opens up opportunities for citizen science. I'm hearing about different creative ways that it's used in research. And so the more that we know about these animals and their behavior and their vulnerabilities, the better off we are. Also, the organizations that are working to help these animals are, many of them are really in need of financial support. So CyberTracker, that's Lewis Liebenberg's project, and by the way, that's all open source, so you can find CyberTracker and you can download it to a smartphone. So he told me that what he is trying to do is to have two-way communication available on this tool, and he's just looking for funding. So I think in this country, you know, Africa is really, really far away,
right.
and so you know, we're not necessarily tuned into the challenges there. And I think that U.S. organizations and individuals are reluctant to get involved in supporting work that's being done, for example, in a place like Zimbabwe, which is politically certainly and economically kind of a mess. So I think kind of looking to see what's going on there. I mean, I stayed at the Africa Center for Holistic Management, and that's a wonderful place to support. I saw, because they have restored the land there using restorative grazing, that's become a place where they're seeing a lot more animals.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is that with large animals like elephants and and sable antelope. I saw lots of sable antelope, and that made me really happy because I know that they're not doing well in most parks, but they're really thriving on the Africa Center's land. But the thing is that the large animals have a wide range, so you're helping them when they're on your land. Right. But if the adjacent land is totally degraded with very poor habitat and you know poor like very you know poor quality and sparse grasses, then that's a problem.
Right. Now within that, just getting back to the Cecil murder.
Oh, Cecil. Yes, yeah, Cecil.
Cecil. Sorry. Murder. I'll call it. Were you there when that happened? Were you in Africa?
No.
You went after. So was there a talk of it? Was there a feeling of it? Did they react the same way people reacted here with the anger? And it just seems like something that maybe wouldn't be as high on most Africans' radar as compared to here. And I'm not saying that in a negative way to them. They have.
I will say that the Africans in Zimbabwe that I met, they very much love their wildlife. One challenge is that if you ask people in Zimbabwe who the elephants belong to, they'll say the big NGOs. So in a way, they're kind of disempowered from engaging with those animals, in a positive way, of feeling a sense of pride and ownership in them. So that's a slight difference, but I'm sure,
I'm asking not in a negative way. I mean, as a hunter here, I feel vested in our system, our tag system, how we hunt. And we kind of police our own, I would like to think, most hunters. We follow the rules. We understand the tag system. We kind of watch the land itself to make sure we don't have poachers. When we see it, it's reported or we try to stop it. And I'm just wondering if that exists in Africa or do they have bigger problems? You know, the people, the common man in Africa, is he like, I don't have time to worry about a lion. I got to feed my family tonight.
Well, I think people were aware of some of the folks involved in that episode and were aware of their less than ethical practices, but this is where the well-being of local communities comes in, because it's not just the hunter who wants to make a fortune and please some American who's paying a lot of money. It's also where they get their information from, and that's the link. That in Zimbabwe, there's where I was, northern or Matabele land north is the poorest district in an extremely poor country, and the poverty was just unbelievable. I mean, the people had a lot of spirit and the communities were intact and the education system is functioning and there are a lot of really positive things happening. But so if somebody has no hope for any employment, there's no food, the land is degraded, and then someone offers you $5,000 for a little piece of information about the whereabouts of an animal, that's really tough.
Right.
So I think people, I think it's part of the picture, and I think people are very upset about poaching. But also, I think that the common Zimbabwe person also has a different relationship with lions specifically, because lions may threaten their livestock, which is their source of wealth. So one thing that's been going on at the Africa Center is that they have this this boma sheeting. It's canvas that protects the corral where the livestock are, where the cattle and goats are. And when they use that, they don't have any problems with lions.
Wow.
So lions no longer are an object of fear. And in many communities, people do shoot lions to protect their wealth. But lions are part of the landscape that they appreciate for their beauty.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Judith, that amazing article. I would highly recommend it to everyone. Is there a link, or where do people go to find the article?
A couple of places. It would be on the Food and Environment Reporting Network website. That's thefern.org. And also at discover.com or .org, Discover Magazine.
Okay.
The Discover Magazine website, it would be under the current issue. And then it'll be showing up on the newsstands shortly.
Awesome. And congratulations. It's a really great article, and thank you for writing it and all you're doing for really conservation and the earth itself.
Well, thank you so much. And you too.
Well, not really, but I appreciate you lumping me in with you. You're doing important work. I'm just doing a dopey radio show, but you can analyze me later.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much, Judith. Well, that's all the time we have today. I'd like to thank Judith Schwartz for joining me today. Amazing article. Please look it up and read it. You've been listening to The Wild Game Domain on Heritage Radio Network. Oh, and I'd like to thank Liz, my producer, for engineering today's show. See you next week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.